Stories of Journey to the West, Chapter 49.
They're standing there, edge of the river, and the first big question hits them. Someone needs to go in.
Right. Into that freezing water to find the master.
And this is where the story gives us this this fascinating detail about Sun Wukong. You know, great sage, equal to heaven, all powerful.
Not in the water. The text is super clear on this. It says he's just not effective fighting in the water.
Really? That feels like a major weakness we don't often focus on. He can do almost anything, but water is a problem.
For fighting, yeah. Seems so. The source says he needs a special water avoidance spell, or he has to transform just to, like, move around down there.
Uh-huh.
And doing that means he can't really wield his staff properly, can't use his main powers. It's a genuine limitation for him here.
Wow. Okay. So the usual smash everything approach is out. He's got to think differently.
But the text immediately pivots, doesn't it?
Mm-hmm.
It tells us who is good in the water.
Ah, yeah. Pigsy and Sandy. It explicitly says they are people accustomed to water.
Exactly. They're the water specialists on the team, naturally suited for this job.
Which leads straight into this, well, this brilliant little sequence, an attempted prank.
Oh, it's classic Pigsy. He sees Wukong is out of his element, maybe remembers a few past incidents.
You think?
Definitely. And he volunteers. I'll carry you, brother monkey.
But the text tells us exactly why he volunteers, right? Yeah. It's not pure helpfulness.
Not at all. It spells it out. Pigsy's thinking, this monkey's tricked me countless times. Now I find out he can't handle water. Perfect.
Yeah.
Old Piggy will carry him, and I'll give him a little payback.
You can just picture him rubbing his trotters together.
Totally. But Wukong? Well, he's Wukong.
He knows immediately, doesn't he? The source says, Wukong immediately knew he had intention.
Instantly. And his counter move is just inspired. Plucks out a hair.
Standard Wukong move.
Makes a fake Wukong body with it, plops that on Pigsy's back. Then his real self shrinks down into a tiny louse.
Hmm.
Pops right into Pigsy's ear, undetected.
That's incredible. So Pigsy is swimming along, probably chuckling to himself, carrying this fake monkey for, what, about 100 lies? Quite
a distance. A long way, yeah. Thinking he's pulled off the prank of the century.
And then he does it. The deliberate stumble.
Yep. Bull Buran deliberately throws the fake Wukong forward.
Oh.
And poof, the hair body just dissolves.
Yeah.
Gone.
And Sandy, poor Sandy, he sees this and he's genuinely worried.
Oh, yeah. He's like, hey, watch where you're going. You dropped Big Brother. Where did he go? Proper concern.
Well, Pixie's just brushing it off. Ah, the monkey couldn't take a tumble. Fell apart. Never mind him.
He thinks he's won. Until.
Wukong speaks from inside his ear. Sandy, old son is right here.
The reveal. It's just perfect comic timing, even underwater.
Sandy must have been cracking up.
Oh, the text says he laughs and tells Pigsy he's basically done for, and Pigsy, absolute terror.
Kneeling in the mud, apologizing.
Profusely. It was my fault, my fault. Please show yourself, I'll carry you properly, I promise. I won't mess around again.
And Wukong lets him sweat for a second.
Just for a moment, yeah. Adds to the effect, then tells him to get up and get on with it.
Mm-hmm.
Such a great snapshot of the relationship, isn't it? Even in mortal danger, there's time for these games.
It really is. Okay, so, prank resolved. Back to the serious business. Finding the master.
Right. They keep going. Sandy parts the water for them. Another 100 lie or so, the text says.
And then they spot something. A building.
Yeah, a structure. And, crucially, it has a sign. Water Snapping Turtle Residence.
Ah. So that's a huge clue right there.
Yeah.
Suggests who the demon might be.
Definitely points them in the right direction. A major piece of intel gathered just by looking.
Wukong, remembering he's not great in the water for a fight, decides on stealth again. He notices there's no water inside this place.
Smart observation. So time for another transformation.
What does he turn into this time?
A long-legged shrimp. Blends right in with the aquatic ticor, presumably.
Good choice. And he hops inside.
And this is where the real intel gathering mission kicks off.
Okay. Set the scene. What does he find in the turtle residence?
He sees the main monster, the Demon King, surrounded by his fishy, crabby minions. The text even mentions one specifically, a striped mandarin fish woman.
Okay.
But the key thing is what Wukong overhears. A conversation. And it's critical.
What is it?
They're planning to eat Tripitaka. And the schedule is tomorrow. The very next day.
Whoa. Okay. Ticking clock. That raises the stakes immediately. How does he find out where the master is being kept?
He needs more detail. He spots another creature, a large-bellied shrimp woman. maybe figured she's approachable.
Worth a shot.
And asks her straight up, well, as straight up as a shrimp can ask, where's the monk?
And does she talk?
Spills everything. Tells him the master was captured when the Demon King made the river freeze over. And he's being kept in a stone box, like a chest, back in the palace somewhere.
A stone box, okay. Oh.
And she confirms the plan. Feast tomorrow, unless those pesky disciples show up.
Yeah.
That intel is gold dust, isn't it? They now know the how, the where, and the when.
Absolutely crucial. So Wukong's got what he needs. He goes looking for the stone box.
Finds it in the back of the palace, just like the shrimp woman said. And the description is pretty grim.
How so?
The text says it looks like a pig feeding trough, or maybe like a stone coffin, about 6 feet long. Gives you a nasty image of the master's confinement.
Grim indeed. And he can hear Tripitaka inside?
Yeah, just faintly. Crying softly. Sheet. Clearly distressed.
Holy poor master.
And Wukong listens as Tripitaka sort of recites this sad poem, lamenting his fate, all the water troubles he's had, the Black River, now this freezing river. He's really down, wondering if his disciples are even coming for him.
That's quite a vulnerable moment for him. Does Wukong talk to him?
He does. Reassures him from outside the box, tells him rescue is coming, even throws in a little line about earth and water elements, trying to sound confident.
How does Tripitaka react?
Urgent. Hurry up. Get me out. Another day in here and I'll suffocate. Understandable, really.
Definitely. So Wukong needs to act fast. He leaves the residence.
Yep. Transforms back outside the gate, finds Pigsy and Sandy waiting.
Time for the debrief.
He confirms it. Yep. It's the monster from the turtle place. He's got the master. He tells them Tripitaka is okay for now, but he's trapped in that stone box and time is running out.
And now they need a solid plan. And this is where Wukong's aquatic issues come back into play, right?
Exactly. The obvious plan might seem like Wukong smashes the place up, but he can't do that effectively underwater.
So they adapt.
What's the new strategy?
It's clever. Pigsy and Sandy, the water guys, they're going to go in and challenge the demon underwater. Start the fight.
Okay.
B-U-T. And this is the crucial part. If they realize they can't beat him quickly down there, they have specific instructions. Pretend to lose.
Fake losing. Why?
To lure him out. Get him to chase them out of the water.
Ah, out of his element. And into Wukong's. Wukong tells them, I'll get out of the water first. He'll use his water avoidance spell, get up out of the riverbank, and wait.
So the plan is, Pigsy and Sandy act as bait, draw the demon to the shore.
Where Wukong is waiting, ready to fight him on dry land, with his full power, staff and all, no water hindering him.
That's actually a really smart tactical move, using everyone's strengths and weaknesses.
It is. So Wukong uses his spell, pops out of the water, and gets ready on the bank, setting the stage for the next phase in the river.
And Pigsy and Sandy show up, not quietly.
No, definitely not. They're just yelling for this monster right at the monster's place, this water residence. Lingan Dawang, they call him.
And out he comes. And the text immediately gives us this... pretty intense description.
It really does. Golden helmet, golden armor, all shiny. Jeweled belt, standard powerful monster stuff, maybe.
Sort of, but then you get these odd details. Like the boots. Smoky yellow boots.
Yeah, those boots stand out, don't they? Feels a bit off-kilter against all the gold. Maybe hints at something.
Could be. And the face description, wow. High nose, like a mountain.
Yeah.
Wide forehead, like a dragon.
Flashing eyes, round, bulging, steel-like teeth. It's building a really imposing image, almost over the top.
And the hair, short, messy, like flames. But then the beard is long, flowing, but sharp, like a golden drill. It's this mix of wild and metallic.
Chaotic energy under the gold, maybe. And the weirdest bit, for me anyway, just based on this text.
The weed.
Yeah. Biting a tender green weed. It's so specific. What's that about? The text doesn't say why, but it makes you pause, doesn't it?
It really does. Makes him seem less like just a generic monster. Adds a quirk, a bit of strangeness, maybe vulnerability or just odd confidence.
Could be any of those. And he's got his weapon, that 9-petal red copper hammer, plus backup.
Over 100 little demons trailing him. And he immediately asks Pigsy, basically, who are you and why are you making noise?
And Pigsy just lays into him, calls him an undying creature right off the bat.
Doesn't pull any punches, reminds him they've met before, accuses him of pretending not to know him.
And states his purpose clearly. Disciple of Tang Monk, heading west for scriptures.
Then the specific charge, you're faking being Lingan Dawang, demanding those kid sacrifices back in Chen Family Village.
Asks point blank, don't you recognize me?
So even from just this text, we know there's history, past trick or encounter.
Which the monster tries to flip, right?
Yeah.
Calls Pigsy unreasonable for the impersonation.
Yeah, it says, I didn't eat you, you just hurt my hand, I let you go. Tries to sound generous.
Like he did Pigsy a favor. Then asks why Pigsy's back causing trouble.
But Pigsy doesn't buy it. He connects the dots immediately. If you let me go, he asks, why'd you then whip up all that cold wind and snow?
Freeze the river solid. Harm my master. He uses the monster's own claim against him.
Exactly. The contradiction is obvious, and the demand is clear. Give the master back now, or face the rake.
And here the monster kind of drops the pretense about the master, doesn't he?
He does. Admits, yeah, that was me. I did the cold, the snow. I captured him.
The gloves are off now, and the challenge is issued. 3 rounds, winner takes all, or gets eaten.
But before they fight, there's that insult. The monster tries to put Pigsy down.
Calls him a monk who joined halfway. Guesses he just worked in a garden somewhere and, like, stole his rake.
Yeah, trying to undermine his whole identity, right? Question his legitimacy as a proper disciple.
Reduce him to a common thief.
Yeah.
But Pigsy is having none of it.
No way. He fires back with this incredible boast about his rake.
Oh, yeah. Denies the theft and just launches into it. Giant teeth like dragon claws. Gold like a python wrapped around it.
And the powers. Causes cold wind, makes flames in combat. Helps the holy monk, beats monsters.
The scale is just huge.
Hmm.
Covers the sun and moon in smoke. Shines with colorful light, knocks down mountains, scares tigers, overturns the sea.
Startles 10,000 dragons, no less. And the final punchline.
One hit from this thing. You're getting 9 holes, guaranteed. He's basically saying his rake is a cosmic weapon.
The monster, maybe understandably, is like, yeah, right, and attacks with his hammer.
Pigsy blocks. And throws the insult right back. Calls the monster a demon who became a spirit halfway.
Ooh, turning that halfway jibe around suggests maybe the monster isn't pure or properly cultivated either.
And Pigsy guesses the hammer was stolen from a silversmith's shop, another attempt to diminish him.
But the monster denies that and gives his own weapon's origin story.
His hammer special too, apparently.
Mm.
9 petals, like a flower bud, hollow pole, like a 10,000 years green.
Comes from a celestial garden, he says. Mentions greenhouse purple Luo Yauchi old, pure white, born in a fragrant green swamp.
So, just like Pigsy, he's linking his weapon to these high-status, almost mystical places. Celestial Gardens Yauchi. Sounds important.
Definitely. Elevating its origin. And he claims he worked hard refining it, so it's like steel and can, get this, communicate spiritually.
Wow. So it's not just a hammer. And he dismisses swords and spears.
Yeah, says they're no match. And tells Pigsy his fancy rake will just get its pins broken if it touches his hammer.
So much boasting. They're defining themselves through these weapons.
It's a real verbal duel before the physical one. But then Sandy steps in.
Right. Sandy's had enough talk. Basically says, actions speak louder. Stop bragging and take a hit from my staff.
The monster blocks and predictably hits Sandy with the same insult. You're another halfway monk.
Guesses he worked in a mill and stole a noodle rolling pin. Seriously.
Yeah, another attempt to make them seem like lowly thieves, not proper disciples with powerful gear.
Sandy curses him out, naturally, and then he launches into his weapon story.
It's rare on Earth, he says. Name isn't widely known. Comes from the Moon Palace.
Another celestial connection. Carved from Siluro immortal wood.
Inlaid with jewels, shining. Gold inside, radiating good vibes, basically. Auspicious energy.
Attended imperial banquets, he says.
Yeah.
So it's got pedigree. High society weapon.
Mm. And now it protects the Tang monk. Maybe not famous on the road yet, but in the upper palace, big name.
The demon-subduing true treasure staff. And like Pixie's rake, it comes with a guarantee. One hit shatters a skull.
So 3 weapons, 3 amazing boastful origin stories linking them all to celestial realms or past glory.
It really sets the stage. Now, this isn't just any brawl. It's a clash of... well, legends, almost.
Exactly. And then the text says they stop talking, expressions change, and they finally fight in the water.
Copper hammer, treasure staff, rake, all going at it. And the text reminds us who Pigsy and Sandy used to be.
Right. Pigsy was a heavenly canopy, Tianpeng. Sandy, a great general, both descended from on high.
Adds weight to it. These aren't just any monks. They have this celestial background.
And they double team the monster. But the monster single-handedly holds them off.
For how long?
2 shinin. That's 4 hours.
4 hours. Underwater. Against both of them.
Yep. Tells you something about the monster's power, at least in his home turf, in the water. He's tough there.
Seriously tough. Despite their weapons and pasts, It's a complete stalemate down there.
Pigsy realizes they aren't winning this way. Give Sandy a look.
And they fake defeat, right? Drag their weapons like they're beaten and run for it.
Tactical retreat. The monster, probably feeling pretty good after holding them off for 4 hours, tells his minions to stay put while he gives chase.
Wants to catch and eat them. The text describes the chase pretty vividly.
Like wind blowing fallen leaves, like rain hitting remnants of flowers, fast and driving them right out of the water.
And guess who's waiting on the bank?
Sun Wukong, just watching.
Sees the water surge, hears the shouts. Pigsy pops out first, then Sandy.
Monster close behind yelling, "Where are you running?"
Sticks his head out of the water and wham! Wukong's right there. Take this staff.
Monster dodges, manages to parry with his hammer. Now it's Wukong on the bank, monster at the water's edge.
But this fight, it's different. How long does it last?
Not long at all. The text is specific. Before three rounds are even finished.
3 rounds compared to 4 hours.
Exactly. Before 3 rounds, the monster can't block Wukong's staff anymore, does some maneuver, and dives straight back into the water. Gone.
Wow. Okay, so that tells us everything, doesn't it? On land, Wukong's power is just on another level compared to this monster.
Completely different ballgame. The contrast is stark. Monster holds off two for hours underwater, but gets routed by one in moments on the bank.
The threat is gone. For now, wind and waves calm down. Wukong's like, "Good job, brothers. Tough work."
And Sandy acknowledges it. Says that the demon was strong in the water, dangerous on land too, but admits they only fought it to a draw down there.
Meaning the 4-hour stalemate, yeah. Then he asks the obvious. Okay, what now? How do we save the master?
Wukong says they need to act fast, worried the master will be harmed.
And Pigsy comes up with a plan based on what just happened.
Yeah, showing some tactical thinking. He says, "Okay, I'll go lure him out again."
You, brother, meaning Wukong, wait. Hidden in the air.
When he pops his head out, give him a solid whack on the head, like pounding garlic.
Huh? Love that image. Even if it doesn't kill him, it'll stun him good.
Then Pigsy follows up with the rake to finish the job.
Wukong's on board. Calls it an inside-out cooperation strategy.
Sounds good. The text says Pigsy and Sandy head back into the water, but then the focus shifts.
Right. It follows the monster retreating back home.
And this is where things get really interesting, focusing on reputation.
The monster gets back. Demons greet him, and this female demon, the Gipo, asks how the chase went.
And the monster tells her, says he ran into a helper on the shore, and admits, crucially...
What does he admit?
That his own copper hammer couldn't handle the helper's iron staff, and that he was defeated in less than 3 rounds.
So the monster knows he was completely outmatched by this helper. He confirms Wukong's power himself.
Exactly. The Gipo asks what this helper looked like.
And the monster gives that description.
All right.
A hairy face, thunder god mouth, pointed ears, broken nose, fiery golden eyes.
The classic Wukong look. And the Gipo hears this, and the text says she shivers. Instant recognition, instant fear.
She tells the monster he's incredibly lucky he got away. Says 3 more rounds and he'd have been dead for sure.
So she confirms the power difference too. But why does she know?
This is the key part, right? She says she heard about this guy from the old Dragon King of the East Ocean.
The word has spread. Even underwater royalty knows about him. And she names him.
The Great Sage equaling heaven. The primordial, vital energy, supreme, pure, golden, immortal, beautiful Monkey King.
The one who caused great havoc in heaven 500 years ago.
500 years. That long ago. And his reputation is still that terrifying.
Apparently so. She knows he's now Sun Wukong, following Buddhism, protecting the Tang Monk.
And her warning is blunt. Don't fight him again. His powers are huge. He has tons of transformations.
It's not just the fight that just happened. It's the sheer weight of that ancient, cosmic-level reputation that scares her and now scares the monster.
And talk about timing, just as they finish this conversation.
A little demon runs in. Boss, those two monks, they're back outside yelling for a fight again.
But everything's changed now for the monster. What does he do?
He looks at the Gipo, acknowledges she was right, and basically says, "No way, I'm absolutely not going out there again."
Total reversal, from issuing challenges to hiding. All because he now knows who that helper was.
Exactly. Fear takes over, his new strategy. Seal the door, tight. Pile up stones, pack mud, ignore them.
Just hide and hope they go away.
That's the player. Keep the door shut, wear them down for a few days, then he can eat the Tang Monk in peace later. The fear of Wukong completely dictates his actions.
So Pigsy and Sandy are out there yelling, but nothing happens. Pigsy gets impatient.
Tries the direct approach, starts hitting the door with his rake.
But it's no good, is it? Door's reinforced now, sealed solid with mud and stones piled up inside.
Even breaking the door panels doesn't help. It's just a thick barrier, impenetrable, at least with the rake.
Sandy sees this and states the obvious. Okay, he's terrified. He's not coming out.
The disciples are stuck, physically blocked by the monster's fear-based defense.
So they decide to head back to the bank, consult with Wukong.
Shamump confirms it when they come back up. The demon just won't come out to fight.
And that seems to be the turning point for Monkey. The source has that line, doesn't it?
Right.
Like this, there's simply no way to handle it.
Exactly. Direct confrontation is off the table. So he announces a strategic shift.
A big one. He tells the others to stand guard.
Right. Watch the river. And he declares he's off to the South Sea, to Mount Potalaka, Shah, to ask Bodhisattva Guanyin for help.
But the plan he lays out for why he's going, it's something else.
Oh, it is. He doesn't just say, I need help catching him.
No. He says he's going to find out the demon's origins, who he is.
Find its ancestral home.
Capture his family.
Ground up the neighbors.
And then come back to catch the actual demon.
It's thorough. The source even has Pigsy commenting, you know, that it seems like a lot of trouble, maybe too time-consuming.
It sounds like complete overkill, doesn't it? Like arresting the whole town for one noisy neighbor.
It really shows Monkey's state of mind, though. When Plan A fails, he defaults to this massive, almost overwhelming Plan B.
Though, thankfully for everyone, that plan isn't what actually happens.
Right. So Monkey states this rather dramatic intention, and then, whoosh, he's off. The source says he gets to Loya Mountain in less than an hour.
Incredibly fast, even for him. And who does he find waiting there? It's quite a crowd.
It is the 24 Devas' dad.
The mountain-protecting deity?
Musa Sudhana. And the pearl-holding dragon girl, a full welcoming committee.
And there's that fascinating little note the source drops about Sudhana Dimma 8.
Yes! Monkey recognizes him. It's Red Boy.
Red Boy. The same incredibly powerful, frankly quite bratty demon kid they fought tooth and nail earlier. Now he's serving Guanyin.
That's him. Quite the turnaround, isn't it? Shows what happens when Guanyin gets involved.
Definitely. So these attendants, including the former Red Boy, they greet Monkey. What's the message from Guanyin?
They tell him she left her usual spot this morning. She's in the bamboo forest, just observing. And she's not really seeing visitors right now.
Okay, but.
They also say she knew he was coming today, also, and told them he should wait quietly out front at the green cliff. And importantly, she isn't on her lotus throne, and she's not adorned,
Right, specific instructions. Wait, she's expecting you, but she's dressed down. But this is Monkey King we're talking about.
Exactly. The source notes his impatience. Says the attendants just couldn't hold him back.
He just pushes past them. Into the bamboo forest.
Straight in. Wants to see for himself, you know. He peeks through the bamboo.
Okay, and what does he see? Because the description here is really striking.
It really is. Guanyin is there, seated, but definitely not on her lotus throne. She's wearing, the source says, a simple, close-fitting jacket, a hat, and a brocade skirt, tied with a belt.
And unadorned.
Completely. Bare arms, bare rows, bare feet. Her hair just tied up simply. Bare feet. Her hair just tied up simply. Jaha. It's a very, very different image from our usual depictions.
Much more. Humble. Earthy.
Exactly. Almost like a common woman, not the resplendent bodhisattva. Very grounded.
And what's she doing? That's the other's
problem. Right. She's not meditating or receiving offerings. She's holding a steel knife.
A knife.
And she's shaving bamboo peel. She's actually making something. Weaving a bamboo basket, it turns out.
Wow. Guanyin, bodhisattva of compassion, sitting there making a basket.
It's quite the image. Definitely not what Monkey or the reader expects.
So Monkey sees this, and he can't help himself, right? He calls out.
Loudly, yes. Guanyin just tells him calmly to wait outside.
Which he does, but then he immediately turns to the attendants, totally confused.
Yeah, he asks them, what's going on? Why isn't she on her throne? Why isn't she dressed up? Why is she in the forest shaving bamboo?
Makes sense he'd be baffled. Do the attendants know?
Nope. They admit they have no idea either. All they know is she went in there unadorned this morning and told them Monkey was coming. They kind of suspect it's related to his visit, but they don't know how.
Okay, so Monkey waits. After seeing this this surprisingly industrious Guanyin, then what?
Well, the source says not long after, she comes out, and she's holding it a finished purple bamboo basket.
Just like that.
Yeah.
And her words are so simple, considering the crisis.
Incredibly direct. Basically, oh. Monkey, let's go save Tang Monk.
And she specifically says she's not changing, right?
Explicitly.
Yeah.
No need to get dressed. Let's go just like this. Barefoot, simply dressed, basket in hand.
And they just coop.
Immediately. Leave the whole entourage behind. They arrive back at the Tongchin River in a flash. Vixie. Pigsy and Shamonk are there. They see her.
And they make a joke about Monkey bringing the undressed bodhisattva.
They do. But respectfully, you know, they bow, admit they couldn't handle the demon.
And Guanyin, does she lecture them?
Not at all. Straight to business. She takes that silk cord from her jacket.
The belt holding her skirt?
Seems like it. Ties it to the basket, steps partly onto a cloud.
Okay.
And throws the basket into the river. Then she starts pulling it upstream.
And she chants something, doesn't she? A specific phrase.
Yes, this is key. The dead go, the living stay.
The dead go, the living stay. How many times?
7 times, the source says. She pulls the basket along, repeating this phrase 7 times.
And then?
She lifts the basket out and inside. Jitteran, a bright, shining, golden fish, still alive, still moving.
That's it. The demon is caught. Just like that.
Just like that. She tells Monkey, go on, get your master. Monkey's still a bit like, wait, but did we get the demon?
Understandable confusion.
And Guanyin just points to the basket. Isn't it in here?
Wow. A simple basket, a cord from her clothes, and a 7-line chant. Problem solved.
The whole massive problem reduced to a fish in a basket.
Okay, let's unpack that reveal. Because Pigsy and Shamunk are confused too, right? How could this fish be that powerful demon?
Exactly. They ask the same question, and Guanyin lays it all out. She says, Janyu. It's her pet golden fish, raised right there in her own lotus pond.
A pet fish? The terrifying river monster that eats children and tracks monks was Guanyin's runaway pet.
That's the reveal. It completely changes the nature of the conflict, doesn't it?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
How did it get so powerful? And what about that hammer weapon?
She explains that too. It gained its power simply by listening to the scriptures every day in her pond. TT. Just by being near the divine teaching.
Okay. So passive learning made it powerful. And the hammer.
The 9-petal copper hammer. That wasn't something it found. It was originally an unopened lotus bud. Marty, from her own pond. The fish somehow refined it, turned it into a weapon.
So its power and its weapon came directly from Guanyin's place. Things she, in a way, cultivated.
Precisely. It wasn't an external evil. It was something from her own sphere that went wrong. She says it escaped during a high tide and ended up here.
And she knew.
Oh, yeah. She says she calculated it was here, causing trouble. And that's why she was unprepared, appearance-wise, because she was busy using her powers, Qis, to weave that specific basket to catch him.
So the whole humble appearance, the basket weaving,
yeah,
it was all purposeful, tailored specifically for this task.
It seems so. The undressed bodhisattva wasn't caught off guard. She was preparing the exact, surprisingly simple tool needed for this specific problem, reclaiming her own lost property.
That is wild. It makes the whole battle seem less like good versus evil and more like tidying up, bringing something home.
Reincorporating it, yeah. Not vanquishing it, which is a really different dynamic.
Okay, so the fish is caught. The truth is out. What happens then? Does Guanyin just leave?
Almost. But Monkey makes a request first. A pretty thoughtful one, actually.
What does he ask?
He asks her to show herself in her current state, with the basket and fish, to the villagers from Chen Village, the ones who suffered so much from this demon.
Ah, so they can see their prayers were answered, see who saved them.
Exactly. He wants them to see the bodhisattva's jush, her golden face, receive her grace, hear the story, and have their faith confirmed.
Does she agree? It seems like a detour.
She does. Says, oh, all right. The source gives her reasoning. Bestow grace. Tell the story of the capture, and crucially, so that mortals will have faith and continue their worship. It serves a purpose for her, too.
So the villagers are called over.
Yes, they rush to the riverbank. The source makes a point of saying they just kneel right there in the mud, overcome with reverence.
And this is where that famous image comes from.
This is it. Someone in the crowd is good at drawing her tech and captures the scene. Guanyin, just as she is, holding the basket with the fish. And that image becomes known as Fish Basket Guanyin, Hoteki Ro, the origin story for that specific depiction.
Amazing.
And then she leaves.
Then she immediately returns to the South Sea. Task complete. Pet fish retrieved.
And the team needs to regroup, find the master.
Pigsy and Sandy, they don't waste any time. They head straight into the water, into what's called the Water Turtle's residence.
Which the monster had taken over, right, as its lair.
Exactly. And inside, well, it's a bit grim. They find all the defeated water monsters, the fish spirits. They're all dead.
So a total cleanup. The demon's influence is completely gone.
Completely. And crucially, they find Tripitaka.
Ah, okay. Where was he?
He was apparently held captive in a stone box, deep inside in the rear palace of this underwater place.
Wow. But they get him out.
They do. They successfully bring him back to the shore, safe and sound.
And back on dry land, I imagine the villagers are pretty happy.
Overwhelmingly relieved. The sources really highlight the gratitude, mentioning people like Shen King and his brothers. You have to remember, these folks had been living in Taro, making these awful annual sacrifices.
Right, right. That annual sacrifice. So this victory is huge for them.
Absolutely life-changing. And Monkey, well, he makes sure they understand it's permanent.
Classic Monkey, being direct.
Yeah, he tells them straight out, no more sacrifices needed, ever. The monster is gone for good.
So it's not just some abstract spiritual win. It's like immediate safety for the community.
Exactly. Okay. It connects the, you know, the big cosmic battle to the very real lives of these people. So, okay, the demon's gone. The villagers are safe. But the river's still there.
The practical problem. Yep. 800 lied wide, wasn't it?
Huge. So Monkey asks the villagers for a boat. Standard procedure, you'd think.
And how do they react after being saved like that?
Pure enthusiasm. The sources say they're incredibly eager to help out, offering everything, you know, masts, oars, ropes, offering to be the crew.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, there's this great detail about them being, making noise, arguing a bit on the riverbank.
Arguing, like fighting.
No, no, not in a bad way. It sounds more like just sheer excitement and everyone wanting to pitch in. A bit chaotic, but well-intentioned.
Got it. So they're all geared up to build this boat.
They're scrambling, ready to go. And then, just as they're about to start, something else happens.
Oh.
A voice calls out from the middle of the river.
Whoa, okay. A voice from the water. That would definitely stop you in your tracks. What did it say?
It tells Monkey, basically, hold on. Don't build a boat. Don't waste the villagers' money. And then it offers to take the whole group across itself.
Offers to take them. Just like that. How do people react on the shore?
Well, a mix, really. Surprise, definitely. But also fear. Some villagers, understandably, just bolt. Run home.
Can't blame them.
Not at all. Others stay, but they're watching, you know, nervously.
And then the speaker reveals itself.
Yes. The creature emerges, and the initial descriptions are quite evocative, square-headed, divine, spiritual, almost like a water fairy. It has this dragging tail suggesting immense age, maybe millennia old, clearly a master of the water. Mm-hmm. And then the source gives the specific identification. It's an old, large-covered, pockmarked turtle.
An old turtle. How big are we talking?
Huge. Its shell alone is described as having a 4-zang perimeter.
4-zang. That's enormous.
Right.
Okay, so this giant turtle emerges.
Mm-hmm.
What's Monkey's reaction?
Yeah.
Please tell me he doesn't just hop on.
Oh, definitely not. His first instinct, suspicion. Total suspicion. The source says he thinks it's another demon, calls it, like, evil beast.
Right.
And he raises his iron staff, ready for another fight. He's probably thinking, here we go again.
Yeah, that pattern's pretty well established by now. Attack first, ask questions later.
But here's where it flips. The turtle doesn't attack back. It speaks. And it immediately explains why it's there. And it completely changes the whole dynamic.
Okay.
It says it's not an enemy. It's actually profoundly grateful.
Grateful. Wait, they just cleared out its home. Didn't they call it the Water Turtle's residence?
See, that's the twist. The turtle clarifies that place. The Water Turtle's residence. It wasn't the demon's originally. It was the turtle's ancestral home, passed down for generations. It had been living there, cultivating spiritual energy for centuries.
No way. So the demon was a squatter.
Exactly. A violent one. The turtle explains the demon only showed up 9 years earlier during a sea tsunami. It attacked, killed the turtle's family, and took over the dwelling. Just seized it.
Wow. Okay, that puts a whole different spin on it. So defeating the demon wasn't just about saving Tripitaka.
It directly restored this ancient turtle's home to it. Undid a huge injustice from the turtle's perspective.
So the turtle's gratitude makes perfect sense now.
Completely. It explicitly says, you know, Monkey and Guanyin saving Tripitaka and getting rid of the monster gave it its home back. It describes the kindness as being heavy as a mountain, deep as the sea. It basically got its life back.
That's incredible. An unintended consequence of the rescue mission benefiting this ancient being.
And the turtle even sees the bigger picture. It points out the other good deed they did.
Saving the villagers.
Yes. Yeah. Saving the villagers from the annual sacrifices. The turtle calls it a win-win kindness.
What do you think? Yeah.
It recognizes that their actions helped both it and the human community. It's quite aware.
So Monkey hears all this. How does he react now? Still suspicious.
No, the source says, hearing this really sincere explanation, Monkey is secretly pleased. He actually lowers his staff. The suspicion fades, replaced by, well, acceptance. The turtle's gratitude seems genuine.
Okay. But does he, double check?
He does. He asks the turtle to confirm its sincerity, and the turtle swears this dramatic oath to heaven. Basically says, if it fails to carry Tripitaka across safely, its body will turn into blood.
Whoa. Okay, that's serious. You don't make oaths like that lightly.
Definitely not. It seals the deal. Shows the turtle is absolutely committed.
All right, so the turtle fairy is a go. How do they actually, get on?
Mm-hmm.
Is Tripitaka okay with riding a giant turtle?
He's hesitant at first, understandably, maybe. He compares the turtles back to that unstable frozen river they crossed earlier. He's worried it'll be just as shaky.
Oh, yeah, that icy crossing was rough. The memory's clearly still there.
For sure. But the turtle reassures him. Says its back is much more stable than ice. And then it adds something important. It says any wobbling would stop it from achieving spiritual merit.
Ah. So carrying them safely isn't just repayment. It's part of the turtle's own spiritual practice.
Seems like it. The stakes are high for the turtle, too. It needs a smooth crossing for its own spiritual progress.
Interesting. So what does Monkey say? Does he trust it?
Monkey basically gives his okay. He says something like, well, creatures that can talk and swear oaths usually don't lie, a kind of practical rule for their world.
Fair enough, I guess. So how do they all fit on this shell? It's big, but still.
There's a specific procedure. First, the horse is led onto the shell. Then Tripitaka stands to the left of the horse's neck, Sandy to the right, Pigsy gets behind the horse.
And Monkey. Where is he?
Monkey's right at the front. And his method for steering is pure Monkey.
Oh, I bet. What does he do?
He takes a tiger tendon rope and threads it through the turtle's nose like a bridle.
Seriously? Through its nose?
Yep. Then he puts one foot on the shell and the other foot on the turtle's head.
On his head?
Yeah.
While holding the rope in his staff.
Exactly. Holding the staff in one hand, the rope bridle in the other. And he warns the turtle, go slow, don't wobble, or else.
Or else he'll whack it on the head.
Pretty much. I'll hit your head.
Oh, Monkey. How does the ancient turtle respond to having Monkey standing on its head threatening it?
Wisely, perhaps, it just says, dare not, maybe thinking about its spiritual merit.
Good call, turtle. Good call. So the journey begins.
It does, and the crossing itself. It's remarkably smooth. The source says the turtle just walks on the water surface like flat ground.
Effortless, despite the size of the river. That 800 lights.
Apparently so. It covers the whole distance with ease.
And quickly. Or does it take days?
Amazingly fast. They cross the entire 800 lies in not even one day. And they land on the other side completely dry-footed. Total contrast to their previous struggles.
That really shows the power of this turtle. And what about the villagers back on the bank?
They watched the whole thing. They stayed there, watching until the group was completely out of sight. And they were bowing and praying, saying, Namo Amitabha, witnessing something truly extraordinary.
A miraculous crossing. So they get to the other side, safe and dry. Tripitaka must be grateful now.
He is. He thanks the turtle sincerely and offers to repay it properly, after he gets the scriptures from the West and comes back, thinking materially, perhaps.
Makes sense. But the turtle has other ideas.
Exactly. The turtle declines any kind of material reward. It explains that it's been cultivating spiritual energy for over 1,300 years. It can speak human language. It's prolonged its life. But it's hit a wall. A spiritual ceiling.
What's the problem?
It cannot shed its shell. Knowing that the Buddha in the West knows everything, past, present, future, the turtle has a request. It asks Tripitaka, when he meets the Buddha, to please inquire when will the turtle can attain a human body.
And Tripitaka agrees.
Readily. He says, I will ask. Promises to do it.
And with that promise,
the turtle turns and slips back into the water. Its job done, its request made.
What an encounter.